The U.S. capture of a Venezuelan oil tanker has drawn new attention to the country's oil reserves as tensions escalate.
Without a doubt, Venezuela could produce 4 to 5 times as much oil as it's producing today.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the current state of the oil industry in Venezuela. Also, a proposed law in Quebec would put added restrictions on public workers wearing religious symbols.
Like a kippah, like a turban, like a hijab. For a lot of folks, it really marginalizes them further.
Plus, fossils in China complicate what we think we know about human history. And we visit a sheep farm in Italy. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. Marco Werman has the day off. We begin today in Spain, where police have taken down a far-right terrorist cell. Its members belong to a global network called The Base, which promotes white supremacy. The group was started in the U.S. in 2018. Its immediate goal is to bring about societal collapse using violent means. Ultimately, though, The Base is trying to create white-led ethno-states, and not just in Spain. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
The alleged Spanish cell of The Base is just 3 guys. But when Spain's national police burst into their apartments in late November, they found lots of weapons.
They had firearms, they had edged weapons, they had a drone.
Joshua Fisher Birch is a researcher with the Counter-Extremism Project. He's based in New York.
The cell specifically had promoted and encouraged acts of violence, and that according to Europol, that they were actually allegedly planning acts themselves.
Europol counterterrorism experts helped Spain track the suspects for months before the bust.
So law enforcement and people who watch white supremacist extremist groups take this group extremely seriously.
So seriously that the European Union, Canada, and Australia have designated The Base a terrorist organization. They say the neo-Nazi group is training recruits to launch attacks against Western society. Experts say there are only about 50 members globally, but online, The Base is actively recruiting. This is a promo video they posted online from Spain in April. In it, a man moves through an abandoned, rubble-strewn warehouse, swiveling a raised rifle, as if in combat. It almost looks like a video game, and that's on purpose, says Luke Baumgartner, with the program on extremism at George Washington University. He says far-right groups purposely go after young white males, especially teens.
One, young people are easier to convince, easier to radicalize, just because of where they are in their developmental stage, you know, mentally and emotionally.
And there's a more practical reason, he says, at least in the U.S.
If you're under the age of 18, you can't be a federal informant for law enforcement. So I'm going to look for 15, 16, 17-year-old guys who can't be paid to snitch on me to the feds.
The Base was founded by Ronaldo Nazaro, a former security contractor who at one time did work for the Department of Homeland Security. He's a self-proclaimed white supremacist, but has said his group is not out to hurt others. In a secret recording of Nazaro on a recruitment call, he says The Base preaches preparedness for when society falls apart.
And the more like-minded guys that we can pull together that have the motivation to get out there in real life and train, that makes us all stronger.
This is from a 2020 podcast called Baseless from the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization that tracks hate groups.
We want to be in a position where we're ready that we can take advantage of whatever chaos that might emerge. We're most of us are national socialists, but there are others who just consider themselves white nationalists. Being pro-white is the number one criteria.
Nazaro was speaking from St. Petersburg, not Florida, but Russia, where he moved around the time he founded The Base some 7 years ago. He now has Russian citizenship. He is said to be running The Base from there and to have ties to Russian intelligence services. Luke Baumgartner says the evidence is circumstantial, but there's lots of it.
You know, there have been reports of Base members noticing, you know, in the presence of Nazaro that Nazaro speaks and writes fluent Russian. He was consistently traveling between Russia and the United States. He is harbored by the Russian government. They were heavily promoting The Base on Russian social media accounts as well.
Nazarov denies he's working for the Russian government. To date, members of the base haven't committed lethal acts of terror, but they have been jailed for plotting to, and for defacing a synagogue in the U.S., possessing illegal weapons, and for threatening human rights activists online. Police have arrested adherents in Italy, the Netherlands, Canada, and now Spain. As for training, mainly it's into the woods for small arms target practice and survival stuff. This is from an online video the base posted in August. Often members wear skull masks, one of several symbols of the so-called accelerationist movement. Again, Luke Baumgartner.
Accelerationism, originally it was more so of a left-leaning postmodern sort of philosophical idea about capitalism and technology. But it's been adopted by right-wing extremists that want to accelerate the collapse of Western society. And so what they hope for is to accelerate the collapse of that society, and in its place, they will institute, an all-white ethno-state, wherever these accelerationists may find themselves.
The base may not have many members yet, but they are not alone, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. In 2023, it found 1,400 hate and anti-government extremist groups just in the U.S., and they're spreading overseas as well. Take the so-called ACTIVE clubs, a global network of white supremacist fight clubs. This one, based in Germany, has an online video showing young men sparring in mixed martial arts. They punch and kick each other. These clubs began in California in 2021 and have spread to Europe and even Latin America, in Argentina and Brazil. On the surface, they're about self-defense and fitness. But Joshua Fisher-Birch says that's window dressing.
Really what the active clubs are trying to do is kind of create this, the idea of this clean-cut counterculture. But there is the element of violence here. There is the element of training for violence.
Less skull masks, more skills. Street fighting skills.
I want to be very clear. The active club movement is a hardcore white supremacist movement. They are hardcore white supremacists. The active club strategy is, let's create something that people actively want to join, where when people see us, they say, hey, those guys look kind of cool.
The worry, he says, is that active clubs could serve as a gateway for people around the world to radicalize further, to become like the suspected members of the base in Spain, stockpiling weapons, planning, and possibly carrying out attacks. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
It's known as Bill 9 in Quebec. If it passes, the legislature there would expand the province's existing ban on displays of religious symbols by public sector employees. It would also require government authorization for prayer in public spaces. Quebec's Minister of Secularism, Jean-François Roberge, says the bill would maintain the, quote, religious neutrality of the state. Critics say the approach infringes on religious liberty. Hasib Hassan is with the National Council of Canadian Muslims. He explained the rules that are already in place in Quebec.
So already in place is Bill 94, and essentially that would prohibit religious symbols in the public sphere. So for folks who wear the hijab, the turban, or a kippah, they couldn't work in any sort of public sector job. So that means teachers, that means crown prosecutors, that means folks who work in the civil service could not wear their religious symbols to work. And for a lot of Muslims, especially those who wear the hijab, it would essentially disqualify them from participating in public life and getting involved in sort of the civil service.
So what would Bill 9 do?
So Bill 9 would prohibit sort of collective religious practice. So things like prayer in public, it would cause issues for universities or cégeps or colleges in the province of Quebec from giving a prayer room for Muslim students or folks from other religions. It would also stop public institutions from offering sort of specific religious foods, so halal and kosher foods.
Quebec's Minister of Secularism and you yourself has said, you know, this applies to religious symbols outside of, for example, the hijab, like a yarmulke or a cross necklace. Why are you arguing that this disproportionately impacts Muslims?
Well, I think for a lot of us is a lot of Muslim women specifically wear the hijab. And that's something that is for them, for a lot of Muslim women, is non-negotiable. It's part of our faith. It is a part of our the way that we sort of practice our religion. And I think with a lot of the rhetoric coming from the CAQ, it's specifically targeting us, right? Bill 9 goes after our ability to practice our faith publicly, right? So if I were a Muslim student and I want to find a private space to pray, usually at universities across Canada, there's a multi-faith room or there's a prayer space that's dedicated. Now the government is able to actually close those university prayer rooms and leaving Muslim students unable to find a prayer space to pray their five daily prayers.
And this is not the same as policy across Canada, correct? Why is this happening specifically in Quebec?
Well, the Quebec political tradition around La Cité and around secularism is something that has been around since sort of Confederation. This sort of limiting of religious expression publicly has been a problem for Muslims who live in the province of Quebec. And often we're the ones who are being used as political tools. You know, the CAQ are going into an election next year. We know that their polling numbers aren't doing the best right now, and they have specifically targeted religious communities, you know, Muslims, Christians, Jews. And I think it's really a political game rather than actual effective public policy.
The CAQ is the governing party that is introducing the bill, and you're saying this is a political ploy to try to boost votes.
Yes, exactly. Right before an election, this is a wedge issue that has been used in the past, and it's being used now again.
You mentioned secularism and laïcité somewhat interchangeably. I'm wondering if you can just kind of define laïcité, the French word for secularism, because it forms the foundation of how French society sees secularism, and that has been brought over to Quebec. But it is a different way to look at it than we do here in the U.S. It has to do with being very neutral in public and keeping religion private. Is that right?
100%. So it's the belief that religious practice should be kept within the home. That is that it is a private thing for an individual citizen, while the public should be neutral, right? So anytime you go out in public, you should be perceived on who you are or sort of based on what you do rather than the religion that you might practice or the ideologies that you might have. And I think that's what La Cité is really about. And for Muslims, right, and for a lot of folks who are part of a religious faith, there is no difference between the private and the public. And that sort of separation between your private and public life causes a lot of issues for folks who might wear a religious symbol like a kippah, like a turban, like a hijab. And for a lot of folks, it really marginalizes them further.
So what's next for this bill? Is it likely to pass into law?
Well, most likely. So they have put the bill forward, and you know we are working with the PLQ, so the Parti Libéral Québécois, along with Québec Solidaire, who are the opposition parties right now in the legislature, and we are pushing the government to listen to the voices of Quebec Muslims. You know, we have come across the world to Canada, and we have Canadians who have grown up in Canada who are Muslim, who are going to be impacted by this bill. And I suspect going into the future that there will be a lot of Muslims who might leave the province of Quebec who do not want to, who feel proud to be Quebecer, who feel proud to speak the French language, and who want to contribute to Quebec society.
That's Hasib Hassan. He's the Government Affairs and Public Policy Director at the National Council of Canadian Muslims. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Authorities in Venezuela have condemned the seizure of an oil tanker by the U.S. as an act of piracy. Washington claims the vessel was part of an illegal shipping network supporting foreign terrorists. Venezuela's Interior Minister, Diosdado Cabello, gave his take today.
La República Bolivariana de Venezuela denuncia y repudia enérgicamente lo que constituye un robo descarado y un acto de piratería internacional.
He says Washington's real objective was to steal Venezuelan oil. Francisco Monaldi has studied the shifting trends in Venezuela's oil industry. He directs the Latin America Energy Program at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. When we spoke today, I started our conversation by asking where that industry stands right now.
Venezuela used to produce 3.4 million barrels of oil before Hugo Chavez came to power, and today is producing about a million barrels, which is less than 1% of the world oil production. So a much diminished role with respect to the past sort of glories of the Venezuelan oil industry.
1% of the total global oil production?
Yes.
And that is just a tiny, tiny fraction of what they could be producing, right? They have, what, the largest oil reserves in the world?
Yeah, I mean, Venezuela has plenty of resources. The official reserves might be overstated, but without a doubt, Venezuela could produce 4 to 5 times as much oil as it's producing today.
And why is that?
It's a combination of the lack of investment, the expropriation of some of the international oil companies that operated in the country, like Exxon and Conoco, and the fact that U.S. sanctions started in 2017 and have, limited some of the potential investment by Western companies.
Right. So the Biden administration froze assets of the state-owned oil and gas company and barred U.S. companies from importing Venezuelan oil. Specifically, what impact has that had on the industry there? How big of a piece of the problem is that?
It actually started with the Trump one administration, and at some point, the Biden administration gave some licenses to Chevron and a few others to operate. But without a doubt, that has made it difficult for foreign companies to operate in the country except when they have a license. Today, the main operator of oil besides the national company of Venezuela is Chevron, which produces about 1/4, 25% of Venezuela's production. Then you have the Russians and the Chinese that for other reasons have been limited investment. So I think it's part of the issue is sanctions, but it's not the only issue. It has a lot to do also with the bad situation of the national oil company.
Right. Can you tell me more about that situation? I mean, we touched on it a little bit, but what are the problems like?
Well, you know, Hugo Chavez fired about half of the employees during an oil strike. And since then, the company has had limited capabilities and has relied much more on its partners. And the wages in the national company got to a level in which even the people who had stayed there started to leave the company. And that is because of the lack of resources of the Venezuelan government. And that has basically meant that the company itself is producing less than half of Venezuela's oil production when it used to produce, 90% before Chavez.
Wow. Back to the sanctions. Is Venezuela trying to circumvent those sanctions in any way?
Yes. Today, the only company that can export with a license is Chevron, that exports about 140,000 barrels to the United States. The rest, more than 80% of Venezuela's production, goes to the black market, almost everything to China, a little bit to Cuba. And basically, Venezuela has been able, using the dark fleet that has developed because of sanctioned countries, to send that oil to China through intermediaries in a way that is not even reported in China as Venezuelan oil, but that's the final destination, independent refiners in China.
You use the phrase dark fleet. I've heard the phrase shadow fleet for shipping sanctioned Russian oil. What does that mean exactly? Is this ships that are kind of just in disguise, like flagged to a different country, and they hide where the oil is coming from?
Yeah, they sort of impersonate other ships. They use flags that are not the real flags. They change their name. They do not have their transponder on, so they cannot be tracked. So this has become very, very large because the fact that Russian and Iranian oil, which are much bigger producers than Venezuela, are also sanctioned sometimes by the US, sometimes by Europe, means that a lot of these tankers are sort of outside the regular sort of rules of international operation.
So the U.S. used to be the biggest buyer of Venezuelan oil. Now, as you say, it is, you know, a very small purchaser. Who is the biggest buyer now?
China, without a doubt. Basically, independent refiners in China, meaning not the national oil companies of China, which are the biggest refiners, but just independent refiners.
Are oil shippers getting worried after the seizure of this tanker?
I think it will depend a lot on if this is a one-off thing or if it's a repeated thing. I think, of course, at this point, there are a lot of ships that are already sanctioned by the U.S., like the one that was seized, that are in Venezuelan waters, and they must be concerned. And, of course, the risk for them have increased. And, of course, there are other ships in the dark fleet or shadow fleet that are not yet sanctioned by the United States, so they might feel less threatened at this point.
There is a lot of uncertainty about what's happening in Venezuela, but there is chatter about, you know, what might happen if there is some sort of change in leadership there. I'm wondering if that is starting to impact the way that oil producers are thinking about potential business opportunities there.
Without a doubt, if Venezuela has a regime change that leads to an oil opening, as the opposition has signaled, that would be a very attractive opportunity for many companies. Of course, the biggest beneficiary in the short term will be Chevron, because it's already there. It's the only major Western company that has a significant presence. Then you have a couple of European companies, but have a very small presence there. And of course, even companies that are not in Venezuela would be really interested, because the size of Venezuela's resources and the fact that it's an industry that already has a lot of infrastructure, even though in decay, will allow for a relatively fast recovery of oil production if the conditions are there. But it will require everything sort of aligning, you know, a new institutional regime and an oil opening and political stability.
Do you see current events in Venezuela and the U.S. Policies toward Venezuela right now having an impact on global oil markets?
If it's just like a one-off event or a few tankers being seized, and thus the amount of oil exported from Venezuela might decline, might have bigger discounts, but doesn't just all go away, and the rest of the world doesn't perceive that this type of policy might also be applied towards Iran or Russia, then I don't think it would have a material impact on the price of oil.
That was Francisco Monaldi speaking with me about Venezuela's oil industry. He directs the Latin America Energy Program at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Up next on today's show, why hundreds of people in dozens of countries all work together to make one red dress. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Art has a way of connecting people, even across borders. The subject of our next story took that premise and turned it into something akin to a visual chain letter. The World's Bianca Hillier tells us about a single piece of clothing that led to hundreds of stories.
Kirsty MacLeod lives in England now, but as a kid, her dad's job took her family all over the place.
So I was born in Venezuela. We moved as a family to Barbados, Nigeria, Japan, Holland, Canada.
While living in Nigeria at age 9, she picked up a skill that would end up changing the course of her life, embroidery.
I went to a craft class that was held by a really dynamic Indian teacher, and she was the one that taught me how to embroider. And yeah, just ever since then, I've just absolutely loved it.
MacLeod went on to study art and textile design in school. In 2009, a few years after graduation, she got an idea and funding for a massive piece of work. She wanted to commission embroiderers around the world to stitch their own designs onto a single garment, a red dress.
My intention was purely just to create this cross-cultural dialogue, and I wanted it to spread the globe.
Consider that mission accomplished. It took 14 years, but McLeod ended up sending small panels of burgundy silk to 51 countries, along with each blank panel, a pretty loose brief.
Just asking the individuals to create something of their own identity and the culture that they're from. So for the most part, I would never know what was coming back.
I really, really wanted something colorful and joyful and tropical, you know?
Catalina Sanchez is one of the embroiderers who worked on the project. She's an ecologist from Colombia.
Colombia is the second country with the highest number of species of birds.
So she added a toucan with its signature orange beak, plus pink flowers and green palm leaves.
For me, that represents my country.
Designs on the dress really vary depending on the country. An Irish woman added a small green shamrock. An anonymous artist from Iran used red, yellow, and orange thread to write Woman, Life, Freedom. And from South Africa came a scene from the countryside. A farmer with an ox plowing a field, a guitar, and a mother gently tending to her children. Ruriko Wyborn is one of the contributors from Japan.
Japan is famous for cherry blossom, so I put the cherry blossom.
She also added a kimono and a few kanji characters, meaning fortune, congratulations, and dream. Project creator Kirsty McLeod says the commissions were even more unique because each artist used their own threads.
So you have everything from hand-dyed cottons to silks to sequins. There's bits of paper on there. There's a scarab shell. There's wool, cording, beading, so many different materials. And I love that because it's real, isn't it? It's authentic. It's what the world is. It's diverse.
In total, 380 people worked on the dress. It's a burgundy gown with a full skirt, fitted bodice, V-neck, and long sleeves. It weighs nearly 15 pounds and still functions as a real dress. But only certain people can wear it.
So just some of the embroideries, really. I get asked by a lot of people for weddings, proms, birthdays, performances. I even got asked by a princess from Madagascar if she could wear it to her coronation. I just say no. So I'm not interested in any of that. It's purely for the embroideries so they can have their moment.
Embroiderer Catalina Sanchez from Colombia hasn't been able to see the finished dress in person, let alone wear it. But she says she feels lucky just being part of this project.
Bringing together so many identities, cultures, backgrounds, beliefs, like being able to be together through this project for me was amazing.
McLeod has taken the red dress across the world as an exhibit in galleries and museums. It has mostly stayed in the UK this year to promote her new accompanying book called The Red Dress, Conversations in Stitch. Next year, though, McLeod is taking it back on the road with plans to exhibit in Australia, Rwanda, the Netherlands, and Vietnam. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The dress, by the way, is stunning. This deep red fabric and detailed embroidery. You can see photos online at theworld.org. Now let's talk about hydrogen energy. It has been one of the flashier areas of innovation for green energy, and it's been seen as key for industries with stubborn emissions problems eventually being able to switch to renewable energy sources. This year, though, has seen some companies pull back from hydrogen. Dozens of green hydrogen projects have been canceled or put on pause. Morgan Rote is the senior director of the Energy Transition Team at the Environmental Defense Fund. When we spoke today, I asked her to explain how green hydrogen works.
So basically, you take a water molecule, you apply some electricity, and you split that molecule into hydrogen.
And then that can then be used to, you know, power your city bus or something, right?
Exactly. It can be used for a lot of different things. It can be used in a ship. It can be used in an airplane. It can be used to make steel more cleanly. There's a lot of different uses for it.
And most of the hydrogen power being used and created right now is not what we call green hydrogen. It is actually produced in a way that makes it not like low carbon, correct?
Correct. Yes. Right now, it's mostly made using natural gas.
Okay. And so green hydrogen is kind of this baby industry, but there's been interest in it for a long time. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the amount of interest and money that has been going into it over the past couple of decades?
So it really started ramping up around maybe 3 or 4 years ago. We saw tens of billions of dollars being announced by countries all over the world. And that was really exciting. It created a lot of momentum around the industry. The IEA mentioned there was around $500 billion of investment that was announced at one point.
The International Energy Agency.
Yes, exactly. But over the last year, really, we've seen sort of a recalibration of the market.
What does recalibration mean? How much money is not being spent on this anymore?
Well, I don't have exact numbers, but you are seeing a lot of projects being canceled. I think we're really moving into a more normal trajectory for a new energy technology. Really, we were starting to see a bubble as they were pointing to hydrogen as their decarbonization solution for absolutely anything that it could be used for. But it actually isn't the best option for a lot of those use cases. Electrification is far more efficient and cheaper. And so we don't need hydrogen everywhere.
Okay, so say you can just keep the lights running in your house with solar panels. It's a lot more efficient to just use direct solar energy rather than having solar energy split water atoms and then using the hydrogen that results to power that.
Exactly.
And why are these projects starting to be canceled now?
The projects that are getting canceled oftentimes are the ones that haven't lined up a clear off-taker or a buyer for the product. There are some projects that are moving forward. The ones that are moving forward have two things. They have a buyer for a really good end use that doesn't have another alternative, and they have governments investing in the infrastructure that's needed to transport that hydrogen to the end user. So China is a really good example of that, that's making investments in both.
That's interesting. I want to get back to China in a second, but I'm wondering, I read this quote from a Wood Mackenzie consultant saying, the willingness to pay any sort of green premium across all low carbon technologies has evaporated. Now, that's a little bit of a wonky thing to say, but green hydrogen is very expensive. So is there some sort of an incentive change that is making companies less willing to pay that premium?
Yeah. I mean, we are in a different environment at this time than we were a few years ago. Everything is expensive. People are really worried about inflation. And so climate is unfortunately not at the top of people's priorities. And so the projects that are being successful are the ones that are not just for climate need, but they're also meeting a secondary need. Hmm. So there's projects in Japan and Singapore that offer an energy security advantage. Or there's projects in the EU that are producing green steel from the clean hydrogen, and they then can, you know, have an advantage over Indian steel that might be dirtier. So we are finding that the business case now can't just be that this is a cleaner product, but that it also offers a secondary benefit.
Hmm. I'm wondering if there's anything of a larger lesson to draw about the economics of the renewable energy transition here. I mean, a lot of it only works if there is a premium on green energy.
Right, exactly. I think we're seeing that all throughout the energy ecosystem right now. There's a really important need for governments to step in to be able to bridge that premium, that cost premium. And they have the advantage of being able to look long term and know that, you know, decarbonization and climate goals will come back in vogue. And we need to make those investments now so that we can reach our long term climate goals.
Green policy is coming back in vogue. That's not a certain thing, but I take your point. Mm-hmm. You mentioned China and how much it is continuing to invest in green hydrogen. Tell me more about what's happening there before I let you go.
So Bloomberg New Energy Finance estimates that of the projects that moved towards completion this year, 60% of those were in China.
Wow.
And that's for a couple reasons. China is investing heavily on all ends of the supply chain. So they're investing in the projects being built, they're investing in the regulations that are going to drive the use of hydrogen, and they're investing in the infrastructure to connect all of those together.
Morgan Rote directs the energy transition team at the Environmental Defense Fund. It is not just main streets that are being transformed by fast fashion. Homespun traditions are feeling the pinch, too. Take wool. In Europe, it's being pushed out by the rise of cheap synthetic materials. Wool has become almost an afterthought for sheep farmers whose main products are cheese and meat. Danny Mitzman reports from Italy for DW.
Pungent and perfect on a cracker with a dollop of marmalade, Pecorino's Italy's most popular sheep's milk cheese. The most famous variety comes from the island of Sardinia, which, no coincidence, has its own Razza Sarda breed of sheep. While cheese and meat have always been the primary resource for Italy's shepherds, wool was, until not long ago, a valuable byproduct.
In passato la lana era una risorsa importantissima.
Slow Foods' Raffaella Ponzio says wool in the Abruzzo region historically made sheep farming families enough money to put their children through school.
Questo dà l'idea di quanto fosse importante economicamente questa risorsa.
But today the situation's very different.
Negli ultimi anni è diventato una cosa più che una risorsa.
Tuscan Pecorino producer Angela Saba says wool's now so devalued, selling it doesn't even cover their sheep shearing costs.
Che non una risorsa.
And she says wool's declining popularity in the clothing sector is only a part of the problem. In Europe, wool's classed as special waste, meaning it has to be washed in specific scouring plants. Over the past decade, they've been closing down, and now there's just one left in Italy.
Preferisco stoccarla, tenerla lì.
Angela says she'd rather keep her wool than give it to people who take it to, say, North Africa, wash it much more cheaply, then sell it back to us at a much higher cost. Instead, she stocks it and turns it into fertilizer, which she says works a treat. Fertilizer is one of the innovations being studied by a European project led by Italy's National Research Council, looking at ways to protect the future of Mediterranean wool. Covering Italy, Corsica and the south of France, the project's called Marlène, mar as in the Italian for sea, len as in the French for wool.
My name is Chiara Spigarelli, I'm a founder of Agrivello. A startup that can convert wool in fertilizer.
Chiara's been speaking at the General Assembly of Wool, a conference Marlène's organized together with Slow Food.
The problem is washing wool. So with the fertilizer, we can make the circular economy without washing, without the washing process, because with the fertilizer, it's not important to wash it.
Having studied wool's potential for her PhD, Chiara decided to turn theory into commercial reality. She's become the only producer in Italy transforming wool, which is nitrogen-rich and highly hygroscopic, into fertilizer pellets.
It's not nitrogen made from lab or a synthetic industry. It's an organic product and the best natural product to fertilize.
Her slow-release pellets allow farmers and gardeners to fertilize just once every 5 months. Currently only in northern Italy, she hopes they'll soon be collecting and converting wool from sheep farmers throughout the country and other parts of Europe. But there are also people here who believe that with a bit of creative thinking, wool can still recover its textile value. Giuseppe De Melis's mother started their family business Maria Antonia Urru in 1981, collecting wool from local shepherds in their native Sardinia and transforming it into thread to make carpets and soft furnishings. He says exploring new uses for wool is part of their evolution. Giuseppe's family business today creates bespoke furnishings and wall panels for hotels and resorts. They also work with designer bag and bed manufacturers, and their most recent new venture is in the car sector, in collaboration with Toyota. Over the next 3 years, Toyota's planning to replace polyurethane foam entirely with natural materials, and their seat prototype, made of 100% Sardinian wool, is one of those being considered.
Questo che stiamo mettendo a punto.
Whether it's for textiles or fertilizer, insulation or cosmetics, the real sticking point people here are keen to address is wool's European classification as special waste. Marlene and Slow Food are advocating to get it declassified to ordinary waste and for the reopening of small-scale scouring plants to be permitted.
Allora, sicuramente occorre prevedere una normativa diversa.
The irony, according to Raffaella, being that industrial wool scouring is itself very polluting because it uses solvents and a lot of water.
Con costi e con passaggi complessi.
So does Mediterranean wool have a future? Yes, thinks Raffaella, if farmers, shepherds and cheesemakers continue to protect and support local breeds and ensure that flocks graze in clear, accessible pastures. That way there'll be high quality wool available in various thicknesses. And then it's down to us to be responsible consumers by choosing wool over petroleum-derived synthetic fibres. Because a healthy coat for a sheep is a healthy coat for us. Danny Mitzman for DW in Italy.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The origin story of the human species is not set in stone. What is set in stone, though, are the fossils that scientists study to piece together our origins. Paul Salopek is a National Geographic explorer who is retracing the path of human migration around the planet. While walking through China, he paid a visit to the Academy of Sciences in Beijing. I asked him what drew him there.
Yeah, my project is premised on following the earliest migrations of humans out of Africa. So every country that I go to, I try to connect with anthropologists, archaeologists to kind of find out, hey, where do I go, right? If you were in my boots and you're walking through your country. And in this case, in China, it was really exciting because it's kind of a new frontier in paleoanthropology. It's opening up and it's kind of like a golden age, if you will.
And while you were there, I understand that you saw a skull that is believed to have belonged to a now extinct species of human. Can you tell me about that skull and what it tells us?
Yeah, so I had the great rare privilege of seeing the actual skull. They were studying it. It's about 146,000 years old. They've nicknamed it Dragon Man. That's kind of an unusual backstory. It was dug up by a farmer in 1933 in Manchuria, way up in northern China. The guy basically tossed it in his closet and was only kind of rediscovered in 2018 when they started then applying modern genetic kind of analyses when they finally did discover that actually, hey, this is really old. And it's from a very interesting part of the human story that there's not much told about. Kind of pre-human, but, you know, after the really, really early kind of species like Erectus, yeah.
So what did this dragon man tell us about our own evolution?
Well, you know, what I remind readers is that when the earliest human beings were kind of walking out of Africa, it was not kind of a depopulated landscape. The continents were inhabited, but just not by us. And it was this amazing time, Carolyn, when if you and I were walking out of Africa, we'd know who we'd bump into over the next hill. It probably wasn't us. It probably wasn't Homo sapiens. It could have been a Neanderthal. It could have been something called a Denisovan, Homo Denisovan. And these are cousins who are, you know, they may look a bit like us and even a lot like us, but they're not the same species. It was a crowded planet at the time.
That's a fun thing to envision when we're thinking about this walk of human migration.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of the lonely ape now. We're the only ones left because as scientists have been telling me, soon after we appeared over the horizon, these other species disappeared. And there's still a debate of how and why. But Dragon Man in China was probably a Homo Denisovan. And the reason why it was such an important find is that all that scientists had until the moment that this skull was analyzed was like a pinky.
So they had identified this whole species based on a pinky finger prior to finding the skull?
That's right. It had been found in Siberia, you know, back, I think, in 2010. And the Chinese skull allowed them to kind of like give a picture, paint a portrait for the first time. Yeah, and this has been happening with other fossils, hominin fossils in China. A new one was recently studied called Yunxian II, which is really old. This guy was a million years ago. And that's kind of upended even the timeline for human evolution.
Right. I understand that Yunxian II was a surprising find, and what we can conclude from it is still controversial. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yunxian II is about a million years old, was found in Hebei province. And at the beginning, it kind of had all the look of an erectus. But when they did the genetic studies, they found it wasn't quite that species. It might have been something a little bit closer to Neanderthals and humans. And if that's true, that pushes back the origin of sapiens way hundreds of thousands of years earlier, maybe even up to 500,000.
Wow.
And so the Chinese scientists have been taking to calling it a new species, Homo longi. But as you mentioned, it's still not confirmed and there's still some debate.
And what would that mean for the whole out of Africa theory of human evolution, which is the basis for this very long walk you are taking?
Well, you know, it would suggest that maybe there was a point of origin in Asia for Homo sapiens, if this in fact bears out. Again, very controversial. And this question also leads to an interesting kind of a version of what societies do, what modern human cultures do with these origin stories. We want to be proud. We want to say, hey, you know, we can't, you know, the cradle of humankind was in Ethiopia or South Africa or ... You know, now that some Chinese scientists are arguing that maybe it was the Far East, maybe it was China. So politics gets mixed in a little bit into this stuff.
Mm. Do you think that these scientists are facing political pressure to put forward this theory that maybe this skull belongs to a very early human ancestor in China?
You know, I think, you know, I've interviewed Chinese paleoanthropologists, and they are top notch. Qiumao Fu at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, foremost, her lab is like making all these incredible breakthroughs. But I will say that one scientist, when I was visiting the Academy of Sciences in China, did kind of suggest off the record that there is pressure, you know, coming from outside, coming from political quarters, to try to frame these discoveries as kind of China first, right? Mm. And you know what? You know, that I think that's fair. But I think this happens again in many societies, modern, you know, political systems. This is a common thing that you kind of have to weed out when you try to take a hard, square look at the science and not the politics.
And is that, do you think that political pressure exists just as a point of pride for these countries, saying, you know, people might have come from here first?
Hey, you know, what could be more kind of a feather in your kind of cap to say, hey, human beings took their first steps in our backyard, right? And so that kind of nationalistic point of pride has kind of, you know, in fact, infected this whole realm of study for generations. That said, you know, I think good science comes out of it. There are amazing discoveries coming out of China.
So taking a bit of a step back, you are on this epic walk, tracing the path of human migration. At the Academy of Sciences in Beijing, you came face to face with some examples of early human ancestors who made that walk or whose ancestors made that walk. How did that feel?
It was really, this is one of the rare privileges of this particular project, Carolyn, is that, you know, I'm a journalist, but one of the fun things I get to do is I get to kind of connect with these amazing people, Chinese, Kazakh, Turkish, all of them, this kind of sisterhood and brotherhood of scholars across the world who are trying to get into focus the picture of who we are and where we came from. So I get to kind of put lay my walking staff aside and pick up a notebook and go into places like the Academy of Sciences in Beijing and be shown this kind of amazing cutting edge science. It's a thrill. It's a real privilege.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek, thank you as always.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
You can read all of Paul's dispatches from the trail and see photos of his journey online. That's at Out of Eden Walk at nationalgeographic.org. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.